This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who will offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Welcome to another edition of Business Impact, the official podcast of UCD Business School. And it's great to have you along as we head into the long summer months when we may just get a short break, at least as we finish and process our exam period here at UCD Business School. Now, we have a very special guest today. We have guests from all over the world, as you know. We've gone across Europe, we've gone across Asia, and oftentimes we go across North America as well. We talk about a whole range of subjects, energy. We've done sustainability, we've done markets, we've done just about everything. One area we haven't quite touched on, I'd say it's probably fair to say we haven't quite got the fullness of the actual discussion, is around the whole area of healthcare. And we do have a UCD graduate who is right in the cockpit of the healthcare debate in North America, but also elsewhere as well. And that guest today is a man called Larry McGrath. Now, Larry is a very interesting man because he has a BCom from UCD. And he's working for CVS. Yes, everyone knows CVS. It is a pharmaceutical group in the sense that has pharmacies on street. But there's a whole lot more to the company as well. And Larry's going to talk to us a little bit about that. He holds the position of Executive Vice President, Capital Markets at CVS Health. And as I said, he is a UCD old boy. I will talk a little bit about his background in a few minutes as well. But he's actually going to talk to us about a whole range of issues in or around healthcare and investor relations, which is one of those jobs that a lot of people have heard of. People know people in the area, but oftentimes in their quieter moments will go, what exactly is investor relations and what exactly and precisely do they do? So we'll also be tracing through that as well. But first of all, let me introduce my guest, Larry McGrath, sometimes known as Lawrence McGrath from CVS Health. Larry, you're very welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much, Emma. Thanks for having me. Yeah, Lawrence, if I'm in trouble, but Larry's good.
So, Larry, it's great to have you on the podcast. Talk a little bit about yourself from your UCD days. I'm going to try and force you to kind of condense a lot of personal history into a short period, but that's just the nature of the beast and what we do here. But talk to us about your time at UCD and the direction your career has gone since then.
So, yeah, I did my Leaving Cert in 1994 and entered UCD to pursue a BCom, ended up doing banking and finance as my sort of third year specialization. So yeah, finished in 1997, so forever ago, pre-Euro. And I love my time in UCD. I born and raised in Ireland, you know, grew up in Dublin, went to school in St. Mary's and Rathmines, and made phenomenal friends in UCD. I still see a number of my BCom friends actually over here in New York, not often enough, but a few times a year. Gareth Holt and Helen Duty and Stephen Kennedy, I'll give a shout out to, because they're the ones I see most frequently. So yeah, I had a great time and really left UCD not entirely sure what it was I wanted to do. I was always sort of more inclined towards the sort of mathier side of business. So that was the banking and finance, and really fell on my feet and fell into investment. So I worked for a period in Irish Life Investment Management and then went to Setanta Asset Management and worked there for a number of years as a sort of a generalist investor, you know, at a sort of junior level in at the time what was more of a startup firm. And then I got the opportunity to work for a company called Pioneer Investments, which was owned by an Italian bank, to really be an investment analyst. So really digging into companies, building models and forecasts, and then, you know, trying to, you know, figure out what we thought the valuation should be and based on that, buying or selling the shares. And that was when I started to specialize in healthcare. So within Pioneer, I got the opportunity to work in a couple of different sectors, but healthcare was the one that really, you know, tickled my fancy. And I just found it so fascinating and still find it so fascinating. It's, you know, a rare sector where you get to see, you know, science happening in real life and innovation having an amazing impact on people's lives. So it's constantly turning over. There's constantly, you know, turmoil. And as an investor, that's what you want, right? You know, you want a sector where there's controversy and an opportunity to get an edge. And healthcare always offered me that. So Pioneer, you know, was a company that had their European headquarters in the IFSC, but had their North American headquarters in Boston. And my wife, Sue, and I had always had a little sense of adventure. And it was from Pioneer that I got the opportunity to move to the States. So they had their office in Boston. I was doing reasonably well in Dublin and started kind of poking them for the opportunity to take over coverage of the US healthcare sector. And eventually that, you know, resulted in me moving to Boston. So that happened in, it was the day before Paddy's Day, 2007, and we've been in the States since. So worked in Boston for a few years and then went down to New York to work for JP Morgan. All the time I was investing in healthcare in JP Morgan, I rose to be the co-PM or the global healthcare portfolio manager. And towards the end of my time in JP Morgan, I had this itch to, rather than just be analyzing healthcare companies and kind of be an informed spectator, to actually make the switch and move into one of the companies that I analyzed and be at the table when those key strategic decisions are happening and be part of that, you know, decision and part of that outcome. So got the opportunity then to join CVS Health about 4 years ago, came in initially running corporate development. I think of that as sort of mergers and acquisitions and divestitures, and then also investor relations. So here, nearly 4 years, I've had a few different roles since I've been here. You know, I ran our strategy organization as EVP and Chief Strategy Officer. I'm now, as you said, EVP of Capital Markets. So that involves investor relations still, also have Corp Dev again, and our pensions and investment division. So you're right, before I jump into questions, there is a common misperception about CVS Health that it's the stores only. And you're right, we have 9,000 community pharmacies across the United States, in every state effectively. And that is the sort of front door to our enterprise. But that's only about a third of our company. You know, we also own a company called Aetna, which is a very large health insurance company. We own a company called Caremark, which is a very large pharmacy benefit manager, which is a part of the business that's kind of unique to the United States, but is a very large company. And then we have healthcare delivery, where we own a number of primary care clinics across the United States through a company called Oak Street. And then we also have MinuteClinics, which people might have seen within CVS stores, where you can get care from a nurse. And we even have a company called Signify Health, where we deliver care directly into the homes of, you know, people over 65 in the United States. So it's a very big healthcare company, which makes a very exciting place to work. And of course, means we get lots of exposure to all aspects of healthcare in the States.
Now, listen, before we go into CVS, which is obviously a big part of our conversation, talk to me a little bit about your professional journey. I mean, you've mentioned you were into the numbers quite early on. You were saying that in your UCD days. And then you kind of mentioned you've done strategy in more recent years. So are you very much a numbers person, or are you coming from the strategy side, which is tends to be less numbery, if I can be so glib about that? So where's your interest, and where, like, if you were sort of god of the world, which area would you most like to do?
That's a great question. Like, I think I'm always drawn to the numbers, but I think through my career, like, when you're investing in a sector like I did for so many years, it's about turning sort of strategic thoughts and strategic insights into numbers, right? So it's trying to figure out, this is where I think this sector is going to go. This is what I think the growth will be, or these are the products that I think doctors are going to want to use, or patients are going to want to use, and then translating that strategic insight into numbers. You know, if that is right, this is what I think that product will be worth, or this is what I think that company will earn, and ultimately, this is what I think the market will pay for that income stream. So I've always been very sort of closely tethered to both sides, which I think was the unique sort of insight or viewpoint that I brought to CVS when I came in. Like, obviously, CVS is a public company. We have a share price. We have shareholders that, you know, buy and sell our stock and that we are beholden to. So having been one of those people before, I think I gave that unique perspective to the management team here when I came in. It's like, if you say that, this is how the market will interpret it. If you do this, this is how I think the street will value it. So they're really closely and inextricably linked, I think, the numbers and the strategy, which is why I love the job I have in CVS and why I've loved the journey that I've had in CVS.
Was the discipline difficult? Because sometimes the critique of the equity community is it's too short term, you know, it's quarters and all that. And then some people say, you know, it's much harder to build long term value, and equity analysts, they tend to be very short term, understandably. And, you know, that's their job. You know, they're judged on that. But yeah. Is it hard to sort of like have that more long view of kind of like, yeah, but where's CVS going to be in 5 years, 10 years? Or do you constantly get pushed into that quarterly cycle where it becomes quite compressed? Or is that something that is a challenge for you as an analyst, both in your previous job, but now sort of on the other side of the fence?
It's such a great question. And actually, when I took over the strategy team, it was one of my favorite and most insightful questions that I got from one of the members of the strategy team. Is, you know, isn't it dangerous to have strategy and investor relations tied together? So I think it can be dangerous, but I think it's, if you're aware of that, then I actually think you have this really unique opportunity to try and build the investor narrative, you know, so the story to the street or the story to shareholders, build it in a way that's informed by a long-term strategy. So it can't be the other way around. You can't drive your strategy because of what investors want you to deliver next quarter or even in the next four quarters, but you can change or build a story that you're going to deliver to investors based on where you think or you know the company's going to go over the next 3-5 years. So, you know, what I'll always tell our senior leaders is, look, the reality is investors aren't going to give us credit for something that they can't put in their model today. But that really informs us on when we disclose parts of our strategy or when we talk to the street about initiatives that we're building, that like shouldn't feel the need to tell them about, you know, innovations until it's really going to be real and it's going to hit your numbers. But that's not a reason not to do it. And when we have like a strategy process here in CVS, which I'm sure is not unique to this company, where, you know, every year we have this, you know, strategic update, and it's a long process for the strategy team. And part of the reason I got pulled into strategy is I would always sit in those meetings as IR, as, you know, investor relations. And, you know, as we're building our strategy, what I'll do is tell them and imagine, okay, 3 years from now, this is what the street will think of that strategy. And this is how it will be viewed. And this is how it will be valued. So if you use that lens, I actually think it can be really, really valuable. So it keeps you focused on the things that are most likely to create long-term shareholder value. And there's different styles of investors as well, Emmett, which is worth pointing out. Ultimately, every investor wants every investment to work every quarter. But there are large, and usually the largest of our institutional shareholders, tend to think more longer term, right? So they want you to deliver every year, but most of their investment cases are built on, you know, 18 months to 3 years or longer. So you also have to have that longer term lens when you're talking to, you know, the Fidelities of the world or the Capitals of the world, or, you know, that was the kind of job I had when I was in JP Morgan.
Now, let's talk a little bit about CVS. As you said, most of our listeners will know the company, mainly because they've probably been in Boston or New York and have had to run in and get a tube of sun cream. They've had to get something like very short termish, and they browse the shelves, which are extensively stocked. So they know the name. As you've already mentioned, they know other names, Duane Reade, they know Walgreens and so on and so forth. So CVS, it's, as you said, it's 9,000 outlets. It's a monster, certainly by European standards. Maybe it's different in the US, obviously, because of the scale issue. But talk to me a little bit about the company. Obviously, you're retailing, you know, pharmaceutical goods made by pharmaceutical companies. So I would sort of immediately think, well, you know, you're a bit of a price taker on the pharma industry. And so just fill me in on how the business works and what are the challenges to stabilize it and make it a prosperous part of the company overall.
Yeah, it's been a really volatile period for pharmacies in the United States in the last, call it, 10 years. So Rite Aid is obviously a name that many folks that are listening will recognize. Rite Aid actually, you know, declared bankruptcy a couple of years ago. Walgreens, you know, had their deal with Boots in the UK and got into a number of challenges. They actually were taken private quite recently. So it's been a difficult sector to navigate. And most people will assume, well, that's because of challenges of, you know, e-commerce and Amazon. And it really isn't. While we always have to figure out how to compete with companies like that and take that competition very seriously, you know, the challenge really was about reimbursement. So as is the case in Europe, healthcare has a real affordability challenge in the United States. Many of you will have read about how expensive branded drugs are in the United States compared to where, you know, what they are in Ireland or in Europe. And it's absolutely true. So we're in a situation now where, you know, 10% of the drugs that we take drive 80%+ of the costs in the States. And that's the branded drugs that you're used to hearing about from Pfizer and Lilly, et cetera, and Glaxo. The rest of the drugs, the remaining 90%, actually are generic medications where there isn't this brand protection or patent protection, and there's much more competition. The use of those drugs in the States actually is much higher than it is in Europe, and the prices are much lower. So in that market, we aren't a price taker. We are, you know, at CVS, we're the largest purchaser of drugs in the world. And we've a lot of, we call it our trade expertise. We have a very big purchasing activity that allows us to kind of take advantage of that and to deliver affordable medications to the United States. But the challenge really was that reimbursement part, where in the way the United States is set up is most people who are of working age get their insurance through their employers. And that's, you know, the world of Aetna. And the, you know, managed care companies, as we call them, the health insurance companies, they get their pharmacy benefits. So the companies that are tasked with negotiating with manufacturers are PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers. That's Caremark within CVS. And then those PBMs will negotiate with manufacturers and with retail pharmacies to try and drive down costs for individual consumers. And that has been a really difficult place for pharmacies to live for a long period of time, that they had gone from a position where generics were growing, they were able to make more of a margin on generics, and, you know, that helped them to offset the reimbursement pressure that they would get from PBMs and insurance companies, to a point where really generics peaked in the high 80% or 90% penetration. So there wasn't that offset every year to reimbursement pressure. And that put huge pressure on the sector and on CVS. And a few years ago, that really came to a head. And you had pharmacists that were under huge pressure to do more in each of their stores. And this is true for the industry. And you actually got to a point where you were seeing pharmacists leave the industry. We had walkouts. And to the credit of people that I work with, and I can't take any credit for this decision, we took a long look at the industry and decided, look, this is unsustainable. And it's so important that we have, you know, high functioning community pharmacists in the country and in our enterprise, that we're going to go a different way. We're not just going to try and cut costs in the face of this reimbursement pressure. And we actually invested a lot in our colleagues, in our technology, in our stores. We tried to find ways, and we found ways to sort of help our pharmacists with their workflow, so that we were able to share workflows across the 9,000 stores. We were able to free up time for our pharmacists to spend more time when they're face-to-face with customers. And all of that actually resulted in a better consumer experience and higher NPS scores. And most importantly, that saw us start to thrive in a sector that was really struggling.
Generally in retail, and I know obviously selling pharmaceuticals is not just any old retail, it's heavily regulated, obviously. But one of the things, there's different ways to get advantage or get market share in retail generally. Pricing is obviously one of them. As you've just said, service efficiency, all that is another one. And a lot of the time it's just physical location, right? You're the local pharmacy, so you get the traffic, right? Is it very hard to kind of innovate in this type of business because it is that basic, down to pricing, location and service level, and there's not a whole lot you can do beyond that? The drugs are the drugs, you know, you don't decide necessarily, you know, who's developing drugs or what they're developing them for, etc. So is it a business that is hard to kind of innovate or make more profitable in the sense of getting more earnings growth, or is it just kind of one of those ones, it's there and it just bumps along? Or like, I might be unfair in terms of managing the business.
I think what you described are like that is table. They are the table stakes, right? In order to compete in what is a very competitive space, you have to have the right locations. You have to have the best cost of goods sold. You know, you have to do the, as they say in the States, the blocking and tackling of day-to-day retail. And then you have an opportunity to innovate, right? So where I think the innovation is coming is more on that, you know, customer service side. So what that looks like for our large commercial customers, so our large employers or the health plans or PBMs that we serve is, can we deliver unique value-added services to their members? So for us, that means, remember, like pharmacists are incredibly well-trained, you know, medical professionals who, you know, have an opportunity to actually help patients to navigate very complex medical situations. So we have, you know, technology now that empowers our pharmacists so that when they're face-to-face with, you know, a patient, they can help them. They can see and figure out if, you know, they need to set up an appointment with a specialist. They can see if, you know, it's someone who's taking a lot of medications, but doesn't appear to have a primary care doctor and maybe hasn't had those, you know, pharmaceutical prescriptions checked or updated. They can do that. They can do things we call like closing gaps in care. They can see, like, if you're a diabetic, like, when was the last time you had your A1C, an important metric in diabetes? When was the last time you had that tested? Or when was the last time you went to see if you have glaucoma, which is a common, you know, comorbidity with diabetes? So that's what innovation looks like for our large institutional customers, if you like. And then for individual consumers, it's that consumer experience. So we have a very powerful consumer app or a CVS app. So we're able to use technology now to help them navigate a very complex healthcare system, you know, help them have a much better pharmacy experience, Aetna insurance experience, Caremark experience. So I think that's where innovation really is. And it's part of the reason, actually, I'm very excited about the potential that AI and, you know, automation offers. I think it's going to really help us to unlock the potential differentiation that we can create because of the different assets that we have in our stable.
Okay. Could I just take a brief detour? Because I do think a lot of our listeners would be interested as well in the career side of our discussion. You're at a senior level here in CVS with your areas of investor relations and so on. And this is a term that I've tried over the years to students of my own to try and interest them in it. And they sort of glaze over a little bit and they sort of think, oh, okay, what's that all about? So I suppose the stereotype of the job is it's kind of glad handling investors. It's sort of like, you know, it's not PR, but it's kind of like investor PR, if you can put it like that. So it's keeping investors engaged, keeping them happy, keeping them buying into the company story and so on. But it's a lot more than that. So do you want to just talk me through a little bit for people who just know literally the title and that's it, and tell me why, you know, sell it to me. Maybe there's people who might think about this as a career option in the future.
I think the longer I've spent in an investor relations function, the more it's kind of, I've realized it's a phenomenal place to work in a company. So it requires a, you know, a reasonably unique kind of person, because you're right. It's again, a little bit like the beginning of our conversation. You have to be very financially literate. You know, you have to understand the P&L and the balance sheet and the cash flow, because you're going to get questions from investors on your published numbers. So you have to be able to read those accounts and understand the drivers of them. But you all have to marry that kind of skill or characteristic with, you've got to be a very good communicator. Like, I think you have to be a good storyteller. And I mean that in the very factual way, but you have to be able to present the company in a way that creates interest. So it is an unusual mix of skills that, you know, will drive someone to be very successful in investor relations. But when you're in it, it's an amazing place to work, particularly in a large, complicated company like ours. You know, a previous CFO of mine describes it as, like, when you're in investor relations, you have a superpower, because when you ask a question to almost anyone across the enterprise, they kind of have to answer it, because they know that if you're asking, it's because someone's going to ask the CEO or someone's going to ask the CFO when they're meeting investors? So we need to know the answer to that. So you get incredible insight across the entire company. And for folks who are early in their career, you know, that's a great jump off spot for you to kind of progress within the company. You get incredibly high sort of visibility in the organization. You're going to sit down with, and again, the folks who are earlier in career in the investor relations team that work for me today, they sit down with the CEO and the CFO and ask some questions and offer insights, and the CEO and CFO listen to them. And it's the same for the presidents of each of our business segments. So it's an incredibly high profile job in that sense. And if you're very good at it and you show yourself to be very smart, it's going to create incredible opportunities for you elsewhere in the organization. And then you're going to know the organization so well, you'll know where you want to go next or what parts of the business excite you. And so it is, it's a fantastic place to work. It's a particularly a fantastic place to, you know, get exposure to a company if you're new to the company or even if you're relatively early in your career. So we're very lucky because of those reasons. You know, we get fantastic talent that raise their hand whenever we have an open spot. It's really exciting. Like, it's, you are at the center of everything that happens in the company. Every earnings report, you're there, you're writing the scripts, you're building the story. We do an investor day every 2 years, which, you know, a few hundred people will attend and a few thousand people will listen to, and you're building the materials. You're watching the stock every single day. So it's a very exciting job.
Yeah, I was just going to ask a question about the diversity of the job. I mean, this may be a US-Europe thing, but is it sufficient to know, you were talking about you need to know your way around the profit and loss account, the balance sheet, cash flow issues and so on. In Europe, we do see a lot more, you know, an increasing focus on other things, corporate governance, ESG, sustainability, all these other things that, you know, 20 years ago, an investor relations professional just didn't need to know very little or nothing about. Yeah. So is that something that's kind of made the job a bit different, so that it's not enough to just walk into the room and say, here's my 10 minutes on the profit and loss account? You need to be able to have your little contributions to all these other areas. Or am I overselling that? It might be a Eurocentric perspective, but has the job changed, I suppose, essentially is what I'm asking you, in the last, say, 10 years?
So, like, I think that's added a layer of sort of expertise or a layer of questioning, a source of questioning, definitely. So, and that's where, you know, the things that you get asked in any given quarter or any given year, they actually change based on what's going on in the market, based on what's going on in your company, or based on what's going on in the environment. So you're right, 10, 15 years ago, and that was when I was at JP Morgan, like, we didn't have any ESG funds. And then we did. So then suddenly that became a topic that I would question investor relations on. So it became a topic that you needed to understand. So, you know, you have to be very plugged in. And we have a team within CVS that does our corporate governance. They have to be very tightly plugged in with investor relations. And I'll do corporate governance calls, and members of the investor relations team will do corporate governance calls on exactly those topics. So you're right. You have to be very agile. You have to be very curious because you're constantly learning new things. You know, you have to be in a sector like healthcare. You have to be very aware and educated on, you know, regulations and rules and what's going on, you know, in Washington, D.C. So it is, it's definitely a job that requires intellectual curiosity. I think you also have to be very strong, right? You have to be willing to, you know, push back on people who are very senior and explain why, no, I don't think it's a good idea to frame it that way, or I don't think it's a good idea to, you know, answer that question that way. So you also have to be very confident. And now that comes with time, of course. I'm not expecting the person who's on their second day to push back on the CEO, but you have to build that confidence and that muscle too.
Yeah, and I suppose it's the ultimate outside in kind of job, right? You're essentially conveying the views of the outside world inside, and sometimes that might not be popular. Can I ask you a little bit about the more global issue, which is healthcare and the cost thereof? Now, we're going to try and leave all the politics out of this conversation, but just zoning in, because it seems to be a subject that's in the news, both in North America and in Europe, and maybe that's just the way it always has been. It's just a little bit more heightened at the moment. But there's lots of people pointing the finger of blame at different sectors, whether it's the pharma makers, the pharma setters, the health insurers, the politicians, the regulators. You know, there's plenty of noise and cacophony around the place. Have you got any perspective on the whole debate? Is it simply a factor of we're all aging in most Western societies, so, you know, there's that whole piece driving at the demographics and so on? Or is it something else? So why is this big debate going on at the moment about the cost of healthcare, who provides it? Or is it, as I said a minute ago, is it just the way it is? It's an important area that always will be kind of an intense area of conversation.
Yeah, I think it will always be an intense area of conversation. It's because actually everything you said is true, right? So we are getting older, and as we get older, we do require more healthcare. We're also progressing science. We're building treatment on treatment on treatment, and that all costs money. And of course, everybody, you know, wants to be treated for everything that ails them. So there's this infinite demand for healthcare. So I think it will always be a conversation, but we have to get better. Like, we're now at a point in the United States where about a fifth of the economy is healthcare. And for as long as I'm willing to go back, healthcare has grown faster than inflation. And, you know, there has to be a point, and I think we're very close to, if not at that point, where we just can't afford for it to grow at the pace that it's growing. So I think there's huge opportunities for us to address affordability. And, you know, without having to, you know, ration care, which is, you know, not what happens in the United States, and it is what happens outside of the United States, there's a lot of froth, and, you know, people in DC will talk about sort of fraud, waste, and abuse. There's a lot of waste in the system that I think we can curtail. And, you know, what we think will be most important to driving that affordability is, you know, engaging consumers in their healthcare. It's very hard to ask an individual who's not a physician or working in healthcare to navigate a really complicated healthcare system. But if we can help them, and if we can power them, you know, through, you know, technology, through the app, through agents that can help them to navigate the healthcare system, you know, we can avoid a lot of that waste. We can ensure that when they're getting care, they're getting the right care at the right setting, and ideally they're getting it at the right time, so you avoid, you know, catastrophic instances that drive people into the hospital. So it's not going to, you know, there isn't a silver bullet, but I think there's huge reasons to be optimistic that we're going to be able to do a lot better. And then there's just huge pressures for that to happen.
One particular area which a lot of people are interested in is weight loss drugs. We know, you know, these brands, Wegovy, Ozempic, and three or four other ones as well. I mean, do you see that being part of the conversation that you've just had? You're mentioning more treatments will become available. They'll eliminate some of the traditional disease categories, obesity and everything that comes out of that. Because, you know, you hear a lot of the talk about how big that area could be. So what's your own sort of a personal view on that?
Yeah, like I think they're incredibly exciting drugs that are far too expensive. So, you know, when they were launched in the United States, those drugs were over $1,000 a month. And that is not sustainable for the amount of people that, you know, should potentially be on those medications. So what you've seen so far in the States, and for our employer-sponsored customers, less than half of those customers are willing to pay for GLP-1s for weight loss. They'll pay for it for diabetes. And in order to get that coverage higher, we've got to drive the price down. And that's where, you know, a company like Caremark has this great role to play. When there is competition in branded pharmaceuticals, so in this case, it's Novo against Lilly, and there are more manufacturers launching, then we can drive the price down. And, you know, we really started that journey last year, and we actually had an announcement here yesterday that we're adding Lilly to our sort of our formulary, if you like, the sort of preferred compounds in that category. And we did that while driving the cost down. So I think the cheaper those medications become, you know, I completely agree. I think they're going to be very powerful in driving a lot of, you know, driving obesity down, and then driving down a lot of those comorbidities. And that's a great example of what can help, but it can only help if it actually changes the total cost of care. So the drugs have to be cheaper in order to to achieve that.
Okay, well, listen, Larry, that's interesting. There's a lot going on in the future is what you're hinting towards in all sorts of different areas. So it's a good few years since you left Ireland, but you've certainly landed an interesting role and an interesting sector. You know, there's always stuff going on, as you've said, and new innovations, the whole pricing debate. I know people get very, understandably so, revved up about this area, but it is interesting, you know, how healthcare is allocated and who ends up making the ultimate payment for it. So it's fascinating stuff. So I'm sure being at the coalface on all of it is great for you. Thank you for joining us. We've enjoyed bringing the story right from the lecture halls of your BCom right through to talking to big investors on Wall Street. It's been an interesting conversation. And thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.